Speaking, a monthly podcast on the spoken word, episode number 88, May 2025. AI and the Human Voice, a conversation with Michael McAuliffe and Tanner Marshall. Hello, Paul Meyer here. Welcome back. Relevant to today's topic, which involves audiobook narration, you might be interested in my narration of Ayn Rand's Anthem, among other audiobooks I've narrated. And I count many other audiobook narrators among my clients, particularly when their project involves accents and dialects. Check out paulmeyer.com/voice-over. Guess that accent. Last time I played this clip from the Idea Archive and challenged you to say where on the planet the speaker grew up.
I was planning to go to work very early, like 4 o'clock in the morning, because it was a holiday, a school holiday, and then I was going to go with the children somewhere to have fun after work, coming home early. But somehow I was too tired and I decided not to do it. And I was very tired sleeping when my daughter started to shake me up, that, "Mommy, Mommy, it's an earthquake."
Your guess? If you picked Hungary, congratulations. It was Ideas Hungary 4, particularly relevant to our podcast today, as you will hear shortly. For the full recording and all the documentation, go to Accents and Dialects on the menu tab of dialectsarchive.com, then Europe, then Hungary. The subject, 50 years old when she was recorded, had moved to California in her 20s. The sample was contributed by senior editor David Neville. Thanks again, David. Now, this month's challenge. Where did this speaker spend his formative years?
People from South have a real thick accent. I would probably have a problem hearing what they're saying. And I think there's actually, I think, fairly big differences in the accents, and a lot, you know, you don't have to travel that far to experience a new dialect. So you can travel fairly short distance, like a 12 drive, in which you would experience a fairly good difference.
What's your guess? Get the answer next time. If you're not listening to me right now on paulmeyer.com, that's the best source. Why not switch over now? Select In a Manner of Speaking from the Other Services menu tab and click episode number 88. We have some extras there for you, not available on any other podcast channel. My guests this month are Michael McAuliffe and Tanner Marshall. Tanner is a senior editor for Idea and a successful dialect coach. The Oscar-nominated film The Brutalist is one of her recent successes. Michael is a linguist specializing in voice-to-text and other areas of artificial intelligence. Cameron Meyer, our co-producer, joins me today. Hi, Cameron.
Hi, it's great to be back.
And welcome, Tanner and Michael.
Hello.
Thanks for having me.
Cameron and I had an instinct that although you come from very different parts of the spoken word world, you'd have interesting things to say to each other. This is our first podcast to seriously delve into AI and human voice and speech, an enormously important and hugely divisive topic. Michael, kick off the conversation for us, if you will, and with a real simple question. Tell me why my iPhone can't or won't accurately transcribe John and Mary and Robert when I dictate a text or an email. It always comes up with some other exotic spelling or puts an apostrophe before it or spells it in all caps. Anything but John, Mary, and Robert. What's going on here, Michael?
So it could be a number of different things. The latest trends in state-of-the-art, in this case, automatic speech recognition or speech-to-text, where you know the input is your speech and you're trying to get some written form of what you said. So those have undergone a radical shift in the past 15, 20 years or so. So around 2010, there was a shift towards starting to use these what are called neural networks, specifically deep neural networks. That's had a long process of development there, where you basically start moving towards what is termed an end-to-end model, where the neural networks no longer have any sort of constraining linguistic input, things like the context in your phone, for instance, or what pronunciations are being used for specific dialects, those sorts of things. Instead, everything gets thrown into this massive neural network of various architectures. The current, you know, sort of mainstream one heavily relies on what are called transformers. They started in machine translation. So if you have an English sentence like, "I love you," and you want to translate that into French, you get "je t'aime." The linear order of the words is not the same in each in each language, right? So if you were to translate the French version into English, you know, in a linear order, you would get I, you, love. Transformers sort of get around this by having more of a summarization style mode of operation, as the automatic speech recognition, you know, things like the speech to text started using transformers more. We get more speech summarization as what is being done. So it's no longer using outside information to influence the spellings of the words, but it's giving a rough approximation of an equivalent written form of what was spoken. One example that I saw just recently on Blue Sky was Microsoft Teams will always transcribe granny as grandma, even though every single time it's very clearly granny and not grandma, right? So there's some standardization going on. There's semantic equivalence is there, but it's, you know, not the spoken form or, you know, the particular form of the names in your contact book.
Yeah, Cameron and I come from an English background, and we call Cameron's mother mummy and not mommy, but Siri refuses to say mummy when we talk about her. It's always mommy.
There is also quite a bit of bias built into these models in terms of the training data. There is going to be the American English bias, even, you know, if you try and set it in UK English, you can influence it a little bit, but it's always going to have that built-in bias.
Tell us more about your work. I know you're the voice to text expert here, and we're going to be talking about a lot about text to voice, of course, but tell us about your work.
Yep, so my background is primarily originally linguistics. So I got my PhD in linguistics from the University of British Columbia. That was work on psycholinguistics, so you know, how we specifically how we adapt to new talkers. So if you have a particular speaker characteristic, how well do listeners learn this? So the one that I was using was an S sound that's pronounced more like sha. So you know, instead of castle, you get cashel. How well do listeners adapt to that? And it really takes, you know, only like 5 or 10 tokens to, you know, or like a single sentence to for human listeners to really adapt to that.
To translate it into their own idiolect or whatever, right?
Yeah, sort of an internal mapping of, oh, this is how this person talks, and so you know, shifting representations in the in their mind to allow them to understand that person better. Yeah.
Yeah, well, that's amazing. That's a good podcast topic on its own, I'm sure.
Yeah, I haven't touched that topic in a while. That was my dissertation. And then I did a postdoc at McGill University in Montreal, where I developed the Montreal Forest Aligner, which is a tool for aligning speech and text together. One of the big issues for phonetic research, so research on speech sounds in linguistics, is finding exactly where certain, you know, vowels are said, certain consonants are said, that kind of thing. And is widely used outside of the phonetic field as well. So it's actually used in text-to-speech models. There was several models that use it mostly for modeling phone durations and getting an accurate model of that.
Cameron, let's get you into the conversation. Congratulations on the Brutalist.
Oh, well, thank you.
People in our field know about the controversy over the use of AI in Adrien Brody's and Felicity Jones' Hungarian language dialogue. Of course, you just worked, I assume, on just the Hungarian accents for the English language dialogue. Tell us about your work on the film.
Yes, I just did the English language stuff. Pretty traditional dialect project. We started with character analysis, and then I present a bunch of samples to folks, or what we might call donors today, real life speakers of the accent that we're thinking that the character would have. Directors and actors sort of choose, and in discussion with me, and then I do my magic on that accent, analyzing it and creating phonetic analysis and all kinds of this and that for the actors, and then off we go. The AI bit was a surprise to all of us, or at least to me, I should say, because I wasn't obviously involved with the Hungarian language work anyway. So I didn't find out about that until yeah, well after we wrapped.
What do you understand about the process that was used?
To be really fair, I only know what I've read and what was on the record. Brady Corbet, the director, went on the record saying that he and his dialogue editor, or was it his sound editor, together decided to use AI as a tool to, now my word, enhance the speech of the Hungarian so that it was more authentically Hungarian, so as if it were a Hungarian speaker. And that AI tool was then woven into Adrien and Felicity's performances. And again, as I read, and as many of us who have, saw, Brady was asserting that the weaving in was down to a syllable often, making a particular vowel change or perhaps a rhythm change. I mean, I can only guess sort of exactly what kinds of changes were made, but that they were really granular, these changes, in a way that, again, from my perspective, seemed to suggest that Brady and his team were really interested in not fussing with the performance too much at all. In fact, trying to retain all the qualities of Adrian's voice and performance as much as possible, if only to then add to it these bits and bobs, if you will, of authenticity.
So that they would appear as native Hungarians to a Hungarian audience, right?
Yeah, I think so.
Michael, what do you know about that process, if anything?
A couple things come to mind. So without knowing the exact AI tool that they were using, right? AI is more of a marketing term than an actual sort of description of the models or, you know, what's going on there. My guess is that they were using something called a voice cloning model, right? Because you still want to preserve a lot of the aspects of Adrian's voice, right? The quality, and, you know, you don't want suddenly to shift into a different talker, right? So you wouldn't be using a text-to-speech model, right? Where the input is just purely text, but instead you'd be using Adrian's performance or the voice line, the Hungarian text, or, you know, an audio clip probably of the, you know, some sort of target that they're trying to get towards, and then generating a sound file from that and probably extracting, you know, as Tenero was saying, you know, a syllable or, you know, these more granular sort of things, and then, you know, splicing it together in some way.
I've read that it's something called Respeecher. Have you ever heard of that program?
I have not.
I can't confirm that's what they used, but I have heard that name come up in conversation related to the film, a program called Respeecher.
Yeah, that's my understanding of what it was as well.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. I've read that too. I wonder if our future as dialect coaches, Tanra, is in danger when AI can be used to correct an actor's less than perfect dialect and accent work. What do you think?
I think it's entirely possible. I also think that there are people who will do that and not give two hoots about a performance. And I think that there are many, many artists and directors and folks in the booth who would never do that to a performance, mm-hmm. who would never change it. And so, you know, I've been thinking about this a lot lately, ever since, particularly since you asked me to join. And I've come to realize that people will use things in different ways, and there will always be, I'm convinced, I'm sure, there will always be those people who want to do something quickly, quick and dirty, as we might mm-hmm. say. In fact, I just had a conversation with a friend the other day who is in video production, and they had fully planned to hire an actor to do the narration for a project. Professional, I think probably what you'd call an industrial video, a sort of in-house corporate video was being made, and they ran out of money and time at the end. That's when the client said, let's go use a voice, not a real voice. And you know, my friend, the producer, sort of shudders and tried to talk her out of it, her client, and was unable to do so. So, you know, that's going to happen. I'm also reading a lot of articles and interviews with directors, producers, and actors too, who are saying that they won't be part of something like that. And I think directors are really the person or the people that are going to be calling this shot the most often. They'll be the ones saying, yes, I will do that, or no, I will absolutely not do that.
Yes.
So I really sort of would like to ask them where they stand, because you know, there are many different kinds of directors and projects, and they all have their own lines that they won't cross, I would think.
Do you know the latest stance that the performers' unions are taking on this stuff?
I don't. Do you? Anyone?
I mean, I know it's been very concerning to SAG-AFTRA in particular, the Screen Actors Guild.
I do recall, you know, from the strike that there were questions about, well, there were movements toward language in the contract to require consent.
Yes.
But beyond that, I don't know.
I know that one of the sticking points in the contract was how actors are compensated when their voices are then sampled and used as either a basis for AI or just used in general for future projects without their consent. So I think the contract, and I might be wrong, focused on that more from a financial standpoint, not necessarily a moral standpoint, not saying you can't use my voice for AI, this can't be an AI project. It was more the compensation, but there might be something in there to control how a voice is used. Of course, an actor owns his or her own voice, but in the context of AI, I just can't fully answer that question.
It's horrifying to think that our voice on one project, without compensation, used on a sequel to that project. Same character, different dialogue, different script.
Let me also throw this out there because it's germane to this conversation. You all might be familiar with the what it's called the Crispin Glover rule. I don't think it's called that, but in Back to the Future 2, when Robert Zemeckis and Crispin Glover couldn't agree on Crispin coming back and performing the role in Back to the Future 2, he sort of faked it. He got another actor and he made him look like Crispin Glover, and everybody thought it was Crispin Glover. and he sued. And the outcome of that was that the industry now says that a director can't go to such lengths as to fool the audience into thinking that it's a different actor.
Mm-hmm.
So you can obviously get that actor's permission to do it. You can make the actor look like the character, but you can't try to completely fool the audience into thinking that that actor is the one playing that character. Now, does that have implications with AI? I think it probably does.
Probably. I think so.
Yeah, I mean, for these models, it's really just a blender of sort of memorized kind of features almost, right? So, you know, one salient example that I had was OpenAI had its creative novel generator. And then, you know, there was one poignant phrase in there that a reporter looked up, and it's like actually just taken straight from a Nabokov novel. These ghosts will live on in these AI models because there is not any sort of intention or choice that's happening inside of the model. It's just sort of, you know, picking the or generating the most likely output, right? For some of these, you'll definitely get these artifacts of like, oh, this is actually, you know, very much from this one performance, or, you know, this one voice, or, you know, especially if it's been fine-tuned on you know, some actor's performance previously.
I can't help but think about our work in accent training. You know, we do, I don't know about you, Tanner, but I do an awful lot of work with real people, not actors, who want to more closely approximate a British English accent or an American accent. And but there's a technology out there now that I've recently come across that whereby, let's say, Indian call center operators can use this technology to turn their Indian accent into general American pronunciation.
In real time. I've heard about this.
Yeah, and it's pretty good.
I
hate to say. But we're going to put a link to their demo on the podcast page. You'll be able to hear a young Indian woman start to speak to us without the technology turned on. And then she turns it on. And yeah, it's so much closer to American English than her Indian accent. And but with little or no loss of her personality or her voice tonality.
Oh, that's interesting. And then it goes to the listener, to the customer, as that sound. So that customer thinks that they're speaking with somebody who actually talks that way when it's actually being processed before
exactly.
it comes to
yeah.
them.
Yeah, the operator's in conversation with the customer, mm-hmm. and it does it instantly in real time. It's amazing.
That is the first time I've heard of something doing it in real time, live. That's
Yeah.
I've seen other demos for, you know, translating, you know, basically translating the language, right? So, you know, in real time, like videos of people speaking English and then switching to Japanese, that kind of thing. There is I think an asymmetry, or there will be an asymmetry between what it does well, right? So translating into American English is very well because that's sort of a lot of its training data. It's well represented. It is the standard in the prestige variety. Anything on the flip side, right? So if it was an American English speaker being translated into, you know, Indian English, I think it would fare much less well in that case. Indian English obviously is also still represented well. So, you know, even, you know, like more minority variants of the dialect, I think it would start, you know, failing harder and harder, especially given, you know, the input.
So this is to do with the size of the data sets that are used to train?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So there's a lot, I mean, you know, in terms of the AI field, there is a lot of English data out there. It is very overrepresented in terms of what is available on the internet. There's like 7,000 languages in the world at the moment, and it's going down. But for most of them, you know, the top 20 are that represents the lion's share of data on the internet.
Cameron, question for you. You had a recent experience trying to clean up a less than perfect interview that you conducted with a major movie star. Tell us about that. I was fascinated by it.
I did. We just finished the Florida Film Festival, and the highlight of the festival for me was getting to interview Mia Farrow. but I interviewed her in a phone interview and the audio was not good. Not really her fault. The interview was fantastic, but just it had that tinny metallic quality that you get from maybe a bad line or whatever was causing that. And I wanted to try to improve that. So first, I sent the audio to a guy that my dad has worked with, a real audio professional, a real guru of professional voiceover and audio. And he asked if it was a single track or a multi-track. And I said, no, just a single track. It's just a phone conversation. And he said, oh, I can't do anything with this. And I thought, well, that's interesting. You know, I gotta trust this guy. But then I sent it to a filmmaker friend of mine. He said, yeah, let me run it through an AI program. And I think he ran it through something called the close-up or close-up preset in Audio Premiere, or sorry, Adobe Premiere. It came back, and within a few seconds, I realized that the audio was dramatically better. It had taken her voice and made it sound almost as good as mine. Mine was good, of course, because I was recording it directly from me speaking. And I thought, oh, this is amazing. This is exactly what I thought AI could do. But then as I continued to listen to it, I realized that though it sounded good, this was not Mia Farrow's voice. Her vowels were slightly different, that the S's were different. It almost sounded like she had a speech impediment. So I simply couldn't use it because I couldn't allow a listener to think, oh, what is wrong with Mia Farrow? This just doesn't sound like Mia Farrow. So I had to reject it. In addition, it wasn't consistent. When my voice overlapped with hers, the AI hadn't picked up her voice. So it went from good to bad. And even the good, as I said, it just didn't sound like her. So I know that AI has come a tremendous way just in the last 16 months. It's astonishing how much it's improving. So, Michael, maybe my question to you is, do the results that I just described surprise you? And do you think maybe in another 16 months, spending 5 minutes with this Adobe Premiere preset would yield different results?
Yeah, so it's not very surprising. So I actually did an internship at a noise reduction company in Vancouver during my PhD. And this was at the cusp of traditional methods of noise reduction, where you have, you know, sort of silence periods that you identify and, you know, you say like, oh, this is what the shape of the noise is, and then use that noise estimation to just kind of subtract from the rest of the speech that noise envelope. And this obviously results in a lot of artifacts in the signal, lots of like jumps and just very weird quality to it. So it's not very good. And then right around that time, you know, neural networks started, you know, again being applied to noise reduction, and you got much better results. But I think the crucial part here, and one of the things that you noted is the single speaker component, right? So a lot of these are going to be trained on clean audio that has noise added to it, right? So you have a ground truth of what the noise or the version with the noise removed is going to sound like. But for a lot of those, the noise and, you know, another talker talking at the same time, those are going to be, you know, kind of similar-ish to like a babble kind of, you know, a cocktail party effect.
I took a stab at it in Audacity, and the problem was there really wasn't any noise to reduce. The noise that I wanted to improve was her voice. So in regular Audacity, there was nothing really to sample and then fix. Now, I know in Audacity, for you sound editors out there are AI add-ons that can work with that program, and perhaps those are improving or will improve too.
Yeah, and so for these general purpose noise reduction AI tools, you know, like Adobe Premiere, right? You don't have a target voice that you're really shooting for, right? If you had like a clean sample of Mia Farrow's voice outside of it there are probably networks that like would or models that would do a lot better at reducing the noise there. But for specifically the notes of, you know, it becoming not her voice, this is sort of this regression to the mean that the AI models have, where in general they'll sort of select for kind of the most likely voices given, you know, the context, the preceding context, the data that it was trained on, you know, the dialects involved, those sorts of things. And so you'll get these sort of shifts towards what would be more likely, or, you know, basically in their training data, and, you know, not necessarily what's actually there, right? These are sort of what's termed hallucinations in the AI field.
I think what I confronted might be a little bit different from a journalism standpoint than somebody might confront in a film, which is more of a creative process. For instance, I couldn't use it because it wasn't an accurate representation of Mia Farrow. So from a journalistic standpoint, I couldn't present that as her. But if you are creating something and you're concocting a film or a song or something like that, and there's no real life journalistic ethics, who's to say you wouldn't just want to use that? It wouldn't matter that the voice changed a little bit. So I think journalistically, maybe we're a little bit safer moving into the future where there's just a rule that will say you can't use AI because it's not real.
I wonder about
Right.
that, Cameron. Would you say, Cameron, that what you heard, this AI rendition of Mia Farrow's voice, did it sound like a person, just not the person of Mia, or was it actually
Yes.
not even? It did.
It sounded like a person, but it sounded like something was just a little off. It's
Of
hard to
this
put my
person.
finger on it. It not so much fake, not like a robot, but having listened to the real recording and then listened to that, her S's were different, and it's just a little something that told me, no, I can't claim that this is her. I wouldn't be right.
Right, I understand, and yet I'm pondering what you're suggesting, that there may be a difference if it were a creative situation and not a journalistic ethical one, but maybe not, because
Yeah.
if so, the change may have been away from who Mia was, but if the change was away from something that's human, you, the director, may still choose not to use it, unless it wasn't that weird.
Yes, true. It wasn't that weird. It sounded human, so a director in a
Yeah,
film
might have used it.
might have used it. It's a bad example, but you can kind of see where I'm going there.
I do,
Well,
I do.
I think it points to the fact that we as humans have amazingly fine-tuned instincts for what is a threat or what something is safe, something's real, something's not real. We have tremendous instincts as human beings with millions of years of evolution to discern the true from the false. And your instincts seem to have been kicking in there, Cameron. And you said this is false. This is not quite right.
Right, I think you might be getting into sort of, what's known as the uncanny valley, right? Where something is approaching lifelike, but not quite there. And if it was less lifelike, you might have actually had a better reaction to it. This is sort of, the zombie effect, right? A couple points that I think this also raises. First, with these AI models, I think there's a large tendency to sort of quote your experience here, Cameron, of the first little bit that you hear of it, you're like, oh my gosh, this is so good. This is amazing, right? You're sort of surprised at how good it is. But whenever you sort of dive into the details of any AI generated output, whether it's text or images or videos or, speech, there's always going to be, as soon as you start looking at it closer, it's like, oh no, there's a lot of missing features that make it not real, right? So, thinking of like the Sora videos that were produced a year ago or so, you had people walking down the street that just vanish into the ground as though, they're Obi-Wan Kenobi in Star Wars. Their clothes just melt into the sidewalk, right? These sorts of things pop up all the time, and it's easier with, videos or images to be like, oh no, that person has six fingers, that's not real. It's less easy with, listening to speech to really, tell what it is that's missing or what it is that's been added that's wrong, but it is very much going to be there as well.
I'm going to ask you, Cameron, to tell the horrifying story that you had at the recent film festival with the song that was generated in 2 minutes flat, right?
It was a little horrifying to me, maybe not to everybody else there. I was at Filmapalooza, which is the international competition for the 48-hour film project. I was there in Seattle last month, and we had an AI workshop. The man who led it was Jahiel Nelson, so I wanted to give a shout out to him. And it went into great detail about AI, and as I mentioned before, just 16 months ago, it was relatively in its infancy compared to where it is now. So it's just jumping forward in leaps and bounds, which is amazing, but it's also quite scary. But because I'm a film critic and I'm focused on the world of film, I'm very much thinking about AI with the movies. But what it can do for music is maybe even scarier because when the workshop started, and it was just an hour long, we were told to shout out words that we wanted included in a song, sort of like Whose Line Is It Anyway or improv. We just shouted out some words, and the gentleman who was helping Jahiel do this took the words and tweaked it a little bit, threw in a couple of other words, and then also asked us to give a genre. And within an hour, so at the end of the workshop, we had a song. And there were no human contributions to that song. The voice, the music, everything was completely AI generated. Quite honestly, it sounded just as good as most of the top 40 stuff you hear now. I'm not a big fan of top 40, so maybe I'm not a good person to judge, but if I'd heard that on the radio, I would have been fooled. And the lyrics were actually okay. It would have taken me maybe a couple of hours to come up with those lyrics. The format, the rhyming, they weren't great, but they were passable. And that just frightened me. So let's go ahead and listen to the song. But let me clarify before we do that what I've already said about this song and share a little bit more information. First, let me thank Duane Tremell and Filmapalooza for use of this clip. Duane worked alongside Jahil Nelson in presenting the AI workshop at Filmapalooza. I mentioned earlier that the song was created in less than an hour. That's because the workshop session lasted about an hour. But the song, or actually two versions of the song, were generated using Suno in less than a minute. In other words, the prompts were entered and it spat out the first version of the song that you're about to hear in under a minute. Then, with some tweaking by Duane, Suno produced in about 10 minutes the version of the song that you're about to hear. Without any actual human singing it, or any human musicians playing the music, or a human writing the full lyrics. I should also mention that we're playing only about half the song here, so the fading out at the end is our doing, not part of the song itself.
Cameron, amazing. That is simply mind-blowing. I had no idea that such a thing was possible. I've heard audiobooks generated exclusively by AI. I heard one in which AI voices were used for all the characters in the book. How is that done, Michael? It seems miraculous to me, but horrifying, having voiced many audiobook projects in my own time. Can you explain that in simple terms?
This would be a text-to-speech kind of example, right? So you have the book in its written form, you have quotes and, she said, and those sorts of things, like markers of dialogue that you can use to basically segment the book into what should be said by who. And then most text-to-speech generators have some presets of voices that they can generate. There might be some capability to sort of override or, generate new voices or that sort of thing. But for the most part, they try to, limit it to like 11 or, depending on the number of accents they have, different genders, that sort of thing, you might have more. And so a lot of it comes down to some pre-processing, right? It isn't just completely take the text from the ebook and, parse it into the audiobook. You can sort of assign voices and, do other natural language processing on the text to say, like who is actually talking at this point in time? Is it narrator? Is it in their thoughts? Or is it, those sorts of things. There are indications in the text for a reader to use, but those are not obvious for any sort of like text to speech, which again is going to always assume, one speaker for the whole thing.
I have a question for you all. It's a question that our colleague Jason Martin has asked with me or of me, as something that is on his mind, and now it's on mine. And it's the question of, can AI yet, or will it in future, be able to speak a line of text with an intention behind it? This is pertinent to we people in the acting world, because one of the tenets of acting is that behind a statement or a question is the hope to achieve something. In other words, one doesn't speak just completely for no reason, that there's a goal behind what's said. So the question is, can AI reveal through the way it asks something what its expectation or goal is without being told in the words itself what that goal might be? So AI might prefer to see, Jane asked, hopefully, if he would be joining her for dinner. But without, in the absence of the word hopefully, would AI be able to put thought or intent behind a question?
So the short answer is no, just because getting a little bit more into the long answer, there is obviously no intention behind these AI models. That is not likely to change because in general they're just sort of this input output framework, right? So the training that's done is given this input, what is the most likely output? There's usually some amount of what's termed adversarial training, right? So like how similar or how close to real can you make it to fool a discriminator network or, one that's trying to pick between what's real and what's false. The way that it's trained and the way that the architectures that are used, there will never be any sort of spontaneous intention behind anything. Without telling it how to do something, it will never
Do it on
do
its own.
it. Yeah. You can certainly, run it through multiple times and, depending on what's called temperature and the network, you can get less likely or, sort of more out there kinds of readings, and then you can select from those, right? That's possible, but it will never have any input into how it's saying anything. This is not likely to change unless there's, some dramatic shift in the architectures. The network model that I mentioned earlier, these transformers, that's what all of the AI hype at the moment has been built around. And there's lots of claims of it's going to be amazing in 2 years, just you wait, general intelligence is coming, all these sorts of things. And that is false. Like, there is no ghost in the machine. There is no, sort of emergent consciousness that's going to be coming from these networks because at the end of the day, they are just, selecting the most likely output given the input.
I guess what I'm hearing from the two of you is that this explains why a more simple speech act, like reporting an event, is going to be easier to achieve a sense of reality. Because you refer to acting, Tanner, and of course, in any acting moment, the character is wanting to do two things in addition to having an objective. They're wanting to reveal and conceal. We have this dual impulse as human beings to reveal and conceal. There are dangers and there are rewards to be navigated. And in dramatic literature, of course, that's the exciting moment where a complex speech act is so highly nuanced. I don't know. Was there a question in there? I don't know.
Well, let me throw one out. Is it fair to say that we're not at the point with AI yet and won't be in the foreseeable future where AI can listen and react? Because so much of acting is not speaking, it's listening and reacting.
There have been some work on speech-to-speech models, is what they're termed. You speak to it, it takes input speech, and then what's output is sort of this text-to-speech with some middle representation of text may be in there, but for the most part, they're trying to basically have a fully functioning, interactive virtual human of sorts. And those are able to do some amount of responding to the interlocutor's emotions. I still think it's pretty hyped up. Like I've listened to a couple of these examples on the blog post, and they didn't sound too far out of the way. And obviously, the human involved was acting, et cetera. I would say that it probably will not get to that point, especially talking about sort of more nuanced performances, right? Like someone holding back tears and talking, or like trying, as Paul was saying, hiding this emotion. An AI is not going to really be able to do the more rare sorts of speech acts simply because those are rare, but they're common for us in, normal human-human interaction that isn't recorded, that isn't online, that isn't sort of a performance.
I'm glad to hear you discuss the limitations, or at least the limitations as they exist now, because I left that seminar at Filmapalooza both excited and terrified for the future, thinking that, oh, in 5 or 10 years, AI will be able to do almost anything, and that we will be left with the choice of not using it. In other words, here's what it can do, and then we have to, as humans, make a choice not to use the AI because it can become a very slippery slope, if that makes sense.
Yeah, again, to my point earlier, AI is not really much a field so much as it's a marketing term. The entire industry of AI and, OpenAI, ChatGPT, et cetera, is entirely dependent on hype to get funding, but they actually lose money on everything that they do. And so it isn't a sustainable business in that sense.
Isn't it getting more affordable?
Each new tier that OpenAI comes out with for ChatGPT is orders of magnitude more expensive, right? So you have like a PhD level intelligence, quote unquote, that's like 20K for a month. And that's obscenely high. And so it really is just sort of this, obscene amount of money for, what is not actually real intelligence.
Interesting.
To be fair, there are also, initiatives that do make it more affordable, things like DeepSeek is a much cheaper model compared to ChatGPT, but there's also this sort of culture in the Western companies. So, thinking of OpenAI, Anthropic, Microsoft, Google, et cetera, where hardware and data have been relatively cheap up until now. The solution for everything is either throw more data or throw more compute at something, throw more GPUs into the mix, and you'll get better performance. We are hitting the limits of the scaling laws, I think, for that, where OpenAI has basically run out of data on the internet for good quality training data. A lot of the training data available on the web is now actually generated by ChatGPT, so it's learning on its own outputs and, not really able to differentiate. So you get even more hallucinations and worse models, from what I was hearing about the latest reasoning model that they released.
The ethics or even the law surrounding mining the internet for stuff you're going to make a profit with. Tell me about the law and the ethics
I mean, I think
of
the law at
what.
this point is that if you were a big corporation, the laws don't necessarily apply to you. One of the things that I've always struggled with as an independent researcher is availability of speech corpora. There was sort of a golden era right before OpenAI released Whisper and ChatGPT. 2020 to 2022, there was a lot more, open source data sets being released online. Those have since like dried up because, anything that gets released is now going to get ingested into a large AI model. I know that Meta recently made the claim that ingesting, I don't know, 7 million books or something into their model had no, because like individually they are not worth it for the model, overall they don't have to pay for it, even though without those 7 million books, they wouldn't be able to do any sort of training or create any sort of model. I would say that the law is not necessarily clear on this, but their legal defense is full of logical holes.
I'd heard too that the amount of data was reaching an end for. So what next? What does that mean? Does that mean that it's sort of going to stall for a bit until there's more?
OpenAI is surviving on hype and debt. There's a very good another podcast, Better Offline, and a newsletter by Ed Zitron on sort of the business side of OpenAI and AI in general. I would recommend that one for sort of more in-depth analysis. But in terms of the technology side of things and sort of the research, one of the really unfortunate things about, the latest ChatGPT hype and all this sort of stuff is that a lot of the research that I've been seeing has involved large language models. So these LLMs and basically testing the capabilities of them, because for academics, you have to publish or perish, right? So you need to lots of publications, and that's sort of the zeitgeist at that moment. There's been less research into new frameworks or like new paradigms for actually transforming the way that we think about these things. Really, at the moment, we've reached kind of the peak performance that we're going to get out of these. One of the things is like you can get to kind of 80% for relatively cheap, but getting beyond that or getting consistent performance or some sort of deterministic where always you will get the exact same output as across multiple runs, some sort of reasoning behind why you got the output that you did, that's lacking in a lot of these. And so the usefulness is very much overstated. It's treated as this inevitability that will happen, where a lot of that is just maintaining this AI bubble.
Cameron, as a movie historian, you have a keen sense of the artifice that movie making has used for decades in actors' voices. I'm thinking here of looping dialogue in post-production, using Marnie Nixon, someone you've never heard of, at least I hadn't until today, to sing the leading roles in My Fair Lady and West Side Story instead of Audrey Hepburn and Natalie Wood. What's the difference, if there is one, between those earlier cinematic deceptions and the use of AI today? I'm playing devil's advocate here, of course. I coached the film Malakai 25 years ago. The leading lady's dialogue was entirely replaced by another actress in post-production. I have some voice actor friends who specialize in voice doubling when the star isn't available for extra lines in post-production. That may or may not be the real voice of Tom Hanks or Morgan Freeman, could be a voice double. It's show business, after all, emphasis on show. Shouldn't we expect deception, sleight of voice, if I can coin that term? Again, I'm strictly devil's advocate here.
It's an interesting question, especially when you consider that film is a technology, going back to arguably when the first movie was made in 1888 by Louis Le Prince. He wasn't painting the movie, he was shooting it on something he had invented. So the technology has been there from the dawn of filmmaking. But to answer your question, I think the answer is actually quite simple. When it comes to voice replacement and looping, it's another human doing it. When you have the actors that you mentioned, Natalie Wood in West Side Story, and I would even mention Claudia Cardinale in Once Upon a Time in the West, that's not her speaking at all in the English language version. It's not just musicals, but it's another person, it's another human who has done it. So, yes, maybe you don't want to give the Oscar to Natalie Wood or Claudia Cardinale because it wasn't their full performance. And there were some people who said that about Adrien Brody. They said, well, if his voice has been tweaked in The Brutalist, maybe we shouldn't give him the Oscar. I think that's not a fair argument because, as we've said, and as Tanira has said, in The Brutalist, it wasn't generative AI. It was being used as a tool to tweak.
A performance, yeah.
Yes, based on perhaps another voice that they sampled and then blended with Adrien Brody. So it's not generative AI.
I would argue that it is still generative AI in that sense, right? There is audio that is being generated, and it does fall into these frameworks, right? So looking up Respeecher online, right, it is very much the same models that you would use for cloning a whole voice or text-to-speech sorts of applications. So it is still generative AI. There is obviously more intention behind it, but it's also, we are relying on statements from the director and from marketing teams and like that kind of thing that is clearly trying to minimize that they used it that much. But it is a slippery slope of, if you don't know for sure, or like you don't have the raw audio to compare it to, or doing sort of a difference analysis, you don't fully know for sure.
Michael and Tanner, let me ask this just to clarify for my own knowledge. I suppose there's a difference between generative AI being blended with Adrien Brody's voice and another Hungarian actor's voice being blended with Adrien Brody. I'm still not quite sure which they did in The Brutalist. Do we know that?
I know what I read in that article that I think it was published, was it in Variety? Interview with the sound designer or sound editor who mentioned it was his voice that they used.
Brody's voice.
No, the sound editor's voice himself. He said that we
Oh.
used my voice.
Okay.
Right, so typically for these voice cloning models, you'll have a stylistic voice input and a content voice input. So you would use the Hungarian speaker as content voice, like this is how it should sound, but it should sound in this other person's voice, right, as the other input. So likely this takes both Adrian's performance as well as, you know, how the Hungarian speaker spoke it.
And then generates its third version,
Exactly.
so to speak.
Yep.
Got it,
A
got it.
sort of a blended version of as though Adrian Brody was saying those things.
That makes sense. And then it was from that that the two of them then pulled, or as we say in the biz, Frankensteined into Adrian's performance. Yeah.
So I guess now that I know a little bit more about that, going back to your question about looping, I don't know if it is just another tool in the technological development of cinema. I don't think it is because, again, it's not entirely a human doing it. I think it's a bit of a slippery slope. I think we have to be cautious about that. So much so that I think people are starting to understand that we have to be cautious. For the first time ever, just a couple of weeks ago at the Florida Film Festival, I saw an animated short film. At the very end of the film, it said no AI was used in the creation of this film. So filmmakers are understanding that people are thinking, especially with animation, oh, did they use AI? And they want to go to that extra length to say, nope, we didn't do it.
What about CGI, though? I mean, to Paul's original question about the grand deception film, CGI has made things blow up that didn't actually blow up, and we've become accustomed to that. And no doubt some people lost work when computers were able to create those kinds of explosions. Looking at it through this lens, it's the same question we're asking here with AI.
Yes, CGI and motion capture and all the tools to trick people. That's been happening since almost movies were created. But again, I see a distinct line because those are tools meant to help do something that you couldn't otherwise do. When AI is used like it was in The Brutalist, I think that's something that's probably acceptable and something we will continue to see, even though I'm not a big fan of it. It's something we will continue to see. But when it goes to that extra length that I was talking about with that song, for instance, that was created in just a few minutes, that's replacing a human. And I think when we get to that, it could be very dangerous and very destructive to the human creative process.
That's a good last word. This isn't the last time that, in a manner of speaking, we'll be visiting these issues. But for now, thank you, Tanner and Michael, for joining us today.
Oh,
Thanks for
thank
having
you.
me.
Yeah, it's been great fun.
And thanks to you for joining Cameron and me, Paul Meyer, and our guests, Michael McAuliffe and Tanner Marshall. Don't forget to follow Paul Meyer Dialect Services on Facebook and Instagram, and me on X or Twitter at DialectPaul. Email me your comments and questions, paul@paulmeyer.com. The audio clip in this episode was used by permission. Finally, you'll be interested to know that since we talked to Michael and Tanner, the National Board of SAG-AFTRA, the Performers Union, of which I'm a member, has overwhelmingly approved a tentative new agreement. Quoting from the email I got from the union, additionally, the commercials contracts now boast the most comprehensive AI protections of any of our contracts and include the first restrictions on using performers' work to train generative AI models. End quote. My guest next month is Sarah Nichols, also a senior editor with IDEA. We're going to be talking about the relationship in the theatre between the sound designer and the vocal coach. Who's in control of what you hear from the actors when you attend a play or musical? This will be a sort of short history of the amplified human voice in the theatre. Should be fascinating. Join us next time on In a Manner of Speaking.